Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Towne, and Melinda Pillsbury Foster, Thursdays at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, along with co-hosts Jake Towne and Gene DiNardo. There's a lot going on in the news. We're going to try to cover as much as we can, particularly the financially related news, including an historic Federal Reserve press conference, first ever, new entries into the GOP race, both Donald Trump and Ron Paul throwing their hats, or at least Ron Paul exploring throwing his hat into the ring. But the big story that we're going to be talking about, and both Gene and Jake have takes on this, is a shakeup at the CIA. Jake, we're going to go to you first and tell us about who's going where.
Oh, yeah. The Obama administration is swapping folks from the Pentagon and the CIA. General David Petraeus, who's served as the leader of the forces in Afghanistan most famously, has been tapped to head the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, in Langley, Virginia. And the CIA director that's there, Leon Panetta, aged 72, has been nominated to lead the Defense Department, or some call it Secretary of Defense, others call it Secretary of War. Currently, we're involved, I guess, in combat with four countries. But Robert Gates, who was a leftover from the Bush administration, I'm actually not quite sure what he's up to, but he is leaving the post of Secretary of Defense.
All right, and of course this has all kinds of consequences both for the military and the CIA. And Gene, I think you have a few details about what it may do to affect the CIA.
Well, what they think is by tapping, they're going to put Petraeus in the CIA post. It's kind of they think it's a reward for him, you know, for his service supposedly, but the other side of it is that Petraeus will now have a limited ability to influence security policy, and people who analyze this stuff think that that's what the administration is trying to do, get him out of that position so they can kind of speed up the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and let's hope that they're right.
That would be a good thing. I don't know if either of you guys saw it, but over at democracynow.org, there was an interview that they did with Ray McGovern, who both you probably know. He's a former CIA senior analyst. In fact, he was with the CIA primarily during the George H.W. Bush administration and served well over 20 years in the CIA. He's been called upon by a number of different news media outlets to express a somewhat different viewpoint from what you normally get through the standard blather coming out of the White House. and the point that he made about Petraeus going into the CIA is that Petraeus, since he was the commander of the whole Afghan campaign, he basically brings a very biased voice to the CIA. So
well,
the question
true.
The government raises is, well, can President Obama actually ever trust anything that Petraeus tells him about what's going on in Afghanistan? And I have to admit, based on looking at it that way, the answer has to be no. How could he possibly trust any of it? Because Petraeus has a vested interest in making sure that it all sounds good.
Yeah, that's true. And you also kind of have to wonder, I mean, I don't know what the exact qualifications for the head of the CIA are, but, I mean, does a general automatically fit that? Or?
Well, he was sending in the Predator drones into Pakistan for quite some time. The CIA was actually in control of those. So
yeah, that's true.
He did have at some point some cross-training with the CIA, but it's going to be an interesting Petraeus, of course, uses his military strategy that he's coined, which is called COIN, I forget exactly what it stands for, counterinsurgency operations. But it'll be very interesting to see exactly how this all plays out, because General Petraeus, again, first impressions as he enters into the CIA, it'll be quite a bit different than the military, and kind of vice versa for Leon Panetta, who's been kind of a lifetime bureaucrat.
Of course, Panetta was very, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Panetta, of course, has been very heavily involved in increasing the amount of drone attacks in Afghanistan, so he's been very much hand in glove with that whole operation.
Yeah, that's true. That's
so
true.
The one thing that it strikes me is that this is one more step along the road of tying the CIA to the military-industrial complex, which, as Ray McGovern pointed out in his Democracy Now! Interview, would probably have Harry Truman spitting in his grave, because Truman intended the CIA to be purely an information-gathering operation, and now they're basically indecipherable and inseparable from the military.
And Defense Department, that's true. And do either of you know about the Lieutenant General John Allen, who's now the deputy at the U.S. Central Command? He's going to take over for Petraeus, and I was wondering if anybody had any info on him as far as perhaps he's less hawkish, and that's why they put him in that post, or maybe this is just people are just hoping this is the case.
I haven't seen anything. Have you seen anything, Jake?
No, it'll be interesting because, of course, some of the other interplays with the military high command in that area is for personnel that are reluctant to attack Iran. Petraeus was reluctant to do that. Admiral Mullen of the Navy was also and still is very hesitant to attack Iran for a very good reason, because it can lead to World War III.
Right.
And just one other note, the United States approved Predator drones for use in Libya, and they've been used in at least some type of limited fashion. So again, I think Walt, you had a pretty good comment that kind of sums it up. Like, the CIA is kind of becoming the military, so why not swap some, do some cross training, just as if you were a corporation, to mesh the those two agencies, or the army and the agency, closer together.
You know, you mentioned the possibility of what would happen with Iran if we were to try to do something there, and likelihood of going to war. But McGovern made a very interesting comment about both Iran and Afghanistan in his Democracy Now! Interview. He said that his friends who are still analysts at the CIA, and he wanted to specify that they are separate from those who are involved in the actions that are taking place in Afghanistan. They're the ones who simply provide the information the way Truman had originally envisioned. But he said that the analysts have basically released over the last few years two different readings, if you will, on two different countries, and that they're both very apropos to what we're talking about here. The first is on Iran, and what the CIA analysts have reported on Iran to the president is that Iran did indeed stop building nuclear weapons as of 2003, and they haven't restarted, which is very interesting when you think about it, especially considering that's not exactly the message we've gotten from the administration, from Hillary Clinton, from many other hawks, and so on and so forth.
Oh, it's the opposite message, right?
Yeah. Second point that he made is that these same analysts at the CIA have also said that the only way that the U.S. can possibly win in Afghanistan is if Pakistan would seal the border and participate in making their top priorities the fighting of the so-called war on terror. And the conclusion that they came to as they were analyzing this is not only can't the U.S. win in Afghanistan for this reason, but also Pakistan absolutely will not involve themselves in shutting down the border or in going after the Taliban and so forth, because they don't perceive that to be in their best interest. They think their best interest is in doing everything possible to oppose India, and that's always been their number one focus. So
right,
the CIA is basically saying that all the reasons for being involved in Afghanistan are wrong.
Yeah. And yet we continue that policy.
Absolutely. Well, we also continue a number of wonderful policies like that domestically, and we actually got to have a slight window into those policies when Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, gave the first ever Federal Reserve press conference this week. Jake, what are the details on that?
Oh, yeah, the Federal Reserve chairman, mainly due to the economic unrest and dissatisfaction with the government over the past 3 years now, of the Depression, have made an effort to, and there's also been a lot of efforts in Congress as well to try and put some more transparency out of the Fed. So Ben Bernanke did give the first ever press conference directly following the Open Market Committee's meeting. At the meeting, they announced that interest rates would stay unchanged at 0 to 0.25%, so basically zero. And I guess the one key announcement is that QE2, quantitative easing 2, or debt monetization, will continue and unabated on schedule up to $600 billion by the end of June.
Said that, were they saying that they would have completed the $600 billion? Is that they were, what they
were? Well, they were considering that there was some thought and some commentary out there that they wouldn't spend the entire $600 billion. They wouldn't add that in full amount to their balance sheet. But what they did decide to do is to continue as scheduled. So instead of tapering off and kind of stopping buying the last part of the program, they decided to keep moving ahead. There was attempts to try and get Bernanke to talk about the future, whether they're going to do a QE3. And he kind of gave a very, wasn't really Greenspanish, but it was still pretty cryptic, just saying that for an extended period of time, they weren't really considering it, but they would take the necessary actions, whatever the heck that's supposed to mean. But he did, what was kind of nice is Bernanke kind of has to think a little bit on his feet, and when he was pressed by a reporter as to how exactly long extended period of time is, he said that it would be 1 to 2 months, which is quite a bit shorter than probably a lot of the reporters had in mind. So as things go on, there was a few other forecasts that Ben Bernanke made, besides directly talking about the stock market for a little bit, which was a bit odd for a Federal Reserve chairman, although obviously stocks and gold hit an all-time high actually during his talk. And silver, I believe, hit an all-time high today, or intraday high, is that he stated that unemployment was expected by Q4 of 2011 to go down to 8.8%. And if my memory is correct, he said by Q4 of 2012, unemployment would be down into the 7% range. So really, not much of a recovery predicted by the Federal Reserve chairman, and that's even with the skewed statistics that the Bureau of Labor and Statistics uses. So my interpretation of that is we're still in a lot of trouble.
Well, he seems to be accepting high unemployment then.
Well, again, they do talk about the mandate of the Federal Reserve, which is stable prices and full employment.
Right.
And that's kind of hilarious to try and figure out exactly what they're trying to do, because the QE is kind of like their biggest attempt to try and stimulate the economy by pretty much throwing money into the bankers' pockets. And the idea is that they would then loan it out to small, you know, this is all theory, it doesn't actually happen, but the theory is the banks would then loan it out to people that wanted to start up businesses, and then the total benefit from those new businesses would be more beneficial than printing up the money in the first place. But that's not what's happening, of course. Loans are still, the banks aren't lending things out. The investment banks are kind of pumping the money into the stock markets and profiting pretty well from that, but the American people obviously are not.
Yeah. Merging.
And that's what a lot of people don't quite get, the whole scientific central banker thing. It's all just kind of a sham for devaluing the dollar.
And there's actually a few other things that Bernanke mentioned in his conference. You talked about how they were talking about ending QE2 as they use up the funds ending in June and perhaps carrying through for a couple months. But he actually made a comment that's just going to carry on longer than 2 months. As usual, they contradict each other. They contradict themselves over and over again as they make their statements. But he said, "We are going to continue to reinvest maturing securities, both treasuries and MBS, so the amount of securities that we hold will remain approximately constant," he said. "The amount of monetary policy easing should remain constant going forward from June." Well, this ties in directly to something that Jim St. Clair of the Sinclair Group of Companies, he's a gold expert whose companies were founded in 1977. He's long been arguing against what Bernanke's been doing and so forth. He pointed out a couple months ago, or actually it was about a month ago, and I think we reported it here on the Freedom News Hour, that the likelihood of ending QE2 was close to zero. What they were going to actually have is QE ongoing. And the way QE ongoing was going to go is that all of those securities that the Fed basically bought up in order to bail out the banks. Well, a number of them are still good. A lot of them are bad, but a number of them are still good, and they're still getting mortgages paid and so on and so forth. So the Fed continues to take in that money. Sinclair said that since it's clear they can't stop QE, they have to keep QE going if they're going to have any hope of achieving the goals that Bernanke keeps laying out. Therefore, it has to come from somewhere, and where the somewhere is going to be all these these payments being made on these securities. So that's why he can say that the overall debt load or the overall inventory, I guess you could say, is going to be relatively unchanged. Of course it is, because they're going to keep getting payments on the mortgages.
Yeah, so they still have access to money they can create.
Absolutely. Another interesting thing that came out of the press conference, and this is actually something that came out of a Reuters video, Bernanke said that he really emphasized that a strong, stable dollar is good for the U.S. and global economy. And in fact, he says the U.S. Central Bank could best ensure a strong dollar by creating conditions for strong economic fundamentals. Now, think about this, guys. Basically, they've been doing everything possible to undermine the dollar. They basically tripled the monetary base. The overall money supply in terms of M1, M2, and what used to be known as M3 are skyrocketing. And all of that, of course, leads to the debasement of the dollar. And here's Bernanke once again saying that a strong, stable dollar is good for the U.S. economy, and that's what our goal is.
Don't do what I do. Do what I say.
Right.
Well, it's also funny because he'll repeat ad nauseum. If you watch enough of these talks, he'll keep saying, well, you know, the strength of the dollar, that's the Treasury of the, you know, the Treasury Secretary's job, Timothy Geithner, when the reality is, obviously, like, as you said, the Fed has a lot more power than the Treasury does in this matter.
It was interesting to see Bernanke talking about how the dual mandate still exists in his mind during the conference. He actually talked about keeping inflation low and keeping unemployment low. So at least in his mind, that long-time dual mandate hasn't gone away.
Right. Another key thing is, because for all the consumers, it's pretty obvious that gasoline is going up, the price of food is going up. Any corporation that you look at from kitchen appliances through Walmart is projecting higher prices because of all the money that's been tossed into the system. And really what you're seeing, a lot of this economic unrest worldwide, particularly in the Middle East, is, I believe, also in large part due to the Federal Reserve policy of expanding the money supply, is really, you know, he's saying that these price increases are very temporary. Don't worry about it. Everything will be fine, because in the long term, the inflation expectations are right around
2%. 2.1 to 2.8%, right.
Right, right.
Everybody
right.
who believes that, raise your left hand.
Right. So that's the whole thing is Ben Bernanke, these press conferences, are their real purpose is to attempt to lie a bit more to the American people, sort of like the fireside chats during the Great Depression that President Roosevelt did, and a little bit like when, if you can recall, President when Obama took office, he tried to do a little bit of the same for the first few months, did a lot of public talks and everything. Everybody calmed down, everything will be better soon with the economy. Everything obviously hasn't been better. But that doesn't change the fact that what they can do is just try and make people feel okay. And that's going to be how it's going to be going for the next few months. But at any rate, what it does create is the opportunities for Bernanke to kind of slip up. And that's one of the things that is pretty amazing, because the stock market, like if you went back to 2008 and before, the stock market would rocket up or rocket down based on what the Federal Reserve was doing with interest rates. And that was kind of, that effect had kind of been dead for a while until the press conference, when right on Wall Street, stocks shot up during the talk. Gold hit an all-time high, still is at all-time highs in dollars, and silver shot up as well. So it's interesting to see the effects of the talk on the financial markets.
I think also it's somewhat unavoidable because with all the audit the Fed activity and so forth, there's been a lot more call for transparency, and so this is the Fed's way of trying to counter that. I suspect they don't really want to do this. for the very reason you described.
What's interesting about that is it says here just as significant was what Bernanke wasn't asked. There were no questions about the lawsuit from the two news organizations that forced the Fed to release the names of all the firms that aided during the financial crisis, nor were there questions about attempts in the Congress to require an audit of the Fed. And then it said before that, in the article I have, that basically they screened who was going to that meeting anyway and pretty much screened the questioning. So
it was a press conference. It wasn't really a press conference. It was more like a Chinese press conference.
Yeah, or fireside chat. I think Chinese press. Yeah. There you go.
But I saw an interesting article that was published actually a week ago. It was published at marketskeptics.com by Eric DeCarmenelle. And in this article, he basically accuses the Federal Reserve of committing deliberate fraud of a different kind. And we've talked about the different kinds of legalized fraud that are involved. And this one, I guess, qualifies as another form of legalized fraud. And tell me if you guys have heard of this one before. I wasn't aware they were doing it. Apparently, the Federal Reserve is selling put options on Treasury bonds and Treasury bills. Now, put option is basically it's a way of using an option to short something. So it's the Federal Reserve saying, if you buy this put option, you're betting that the dollar is going to go haywire and that the bonds are going to lose all their value. Well, as he pointed out, as Carbonell points out, that's fraud because the Federal Reserve is responsible for keeping the money supply up and is supposedly trying to do everything they can to do that. And yet here they are basically selling themselves short.
They actually know they're doing that?
It's a matter of record. He found reports within the minutes of the FOMC, the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee. I do that acronym backward, I think I did, the FOMC, that showed that they were definitely involved in a policy of selling put options on treasuries.
That borders on the unreal.
What's even more unreal is how few analysts have actually noticed it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when the Fed is actually actively involved in selling itself short, why should the rest of us disagree?
Yeah, exactly.
Does raise questions in the mind. Well, unfortunately, the Fed isn't the only thing going on. There's all kinds of things going on, including, believe it or not, even though we're only in 2011, they're starting the presidential race without us. And Jake, why don't you give us some of the details on the two candidates, one who's actually two of them who are in the middle of exploring whether or not they should be presidential nominees.
Right. Well, President Ron Paul, Congressman Ron Paul,
getting a little ahead of
in our dreams. But Congressman Ron Paul has set up an exploratory committee, and what I believe that means for president is that he filed his papers. So, of course, he could withdraw and decide not to run. But what he has really done is throw his hat into the ring. So he is a candidate for president right now. So. What that entails is, pretty much the first debate will be held on Fox at 9 p.m., I believe, Eastern Time on May 5th, which really isn't all that far from now. And I haven't seen a candidate list for that, but you also had, there was a Governor Haley Barbour in the Midwest who dropped out of the presidential race. Of course, folks like Mitt Romney are still in. Donald Trump he flew in on his Trump helicopter in New Hampshire and was doing shake hand stops and giving some talks and everything. There was a whole debacle with the Obama certificate of live birth that went on, I believe, yesterday. So it's as far as I know, Trump hasn't officially filed any papers or formed an exploratory committee. And it'll be interesting to see if he does, in fact, show up at that debate on May 5th.
Maybe he could just buy the government.
Yeah.
He's probably trying to do just that. I wouldn't be surprised at all. The interesting part of that report, though, is what Congressman Paul is doing, because there's been a lot of speculation that he would not try to run again simply because of his age. And, in fact, there's an article that appeared in the New York Sun. Paul actually met with the Sun editorial board and at a breakfast, and this article was basically a takeaway from that particular meeting. In that meeting, he basically said he was tempted to just walk away from the presidential race. But if what we're predicting happens, he said, we're going to have to step up. So it sounds like Congressman Paul is actually thinking about running because he feels he ought to, given what's happening to the economy.
And he would probably run on the Republican ticket?
Yeah, that's always been his plan. He doesn't want to do a third-party thing anymore. He did that once with the Libertarian Party and learned firsthand all the trials and tribulations of trying to run as a third-party candidate. So despite the fact that apparently former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura has volunteered that he would be happy to run as Ron Paul's vice presidential candidate.
Oh, that would help.
if and only if Paul were to run as a third-party candidate, it doesn't seem likely to me that that's what Paul's going to do.
Right, and just for a background for our listeners, just the like if you're running for president in the state of Pennsylvania as a Republican or a Democrat, I believe the number is 2,000 signatures. You only need to collect 2,000 signatures. When I ran as an independent just for Congress, local United States Congress, the requirement for me was, I believe, somewhere around 5,000 signatures. And if you were to run as an independent for president in Pennsylvania instead of the 2,000 that Republican or Democrat needs, or even if you ran as a Libertarian, I believe the number would be well north of 20,000 signatures, and we probably need 40 to 50,000 to be on the safe side.
Well, that's fair.
That's really fair. That's really nice.
Oh, yeah, that's perfectly fair, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Why should the average person have any chance against the elite? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
That we need to stamp that kind of thing out, right?
Yeah, we don't want average people running.
One thing that did come out of that Sun article, which was kind of interesting, is that Paul was asked about his son, Rand Paul, and the fact that Rand has some slightly different takes on some of the issues. And Dr. Paul basically said, well, there are a couple things I got to straighten my son out on.
Yeah, he's always been a wild kid.
So I thought that was kind of fun, too. Well, there's also other things going on in politics, and in fact, Gene, you have an interesting article about what's happening with the stimulus money. I believe it came from PolitiFact, but I don't know all the details. Why don't you give us the details on that?
Yeah, this did come from PolitiFact, and they search out what politicians say and try to figure out what small percentage is actually true. But Obama was asked when he was doing a in Dallas, he was being questioned by television reporters, and they asked him whether he agreed with Texas leaders that the federal government should take some of their governing cues from the Lone Star State. And Obama had said, well, there's a little inconsistency in that. And he went on to say that, keep in mind that Governor Perry helped balance his budget with about $6 billion worth of federal help. He was speaking of stimulus money. And then immediately started blaming members of Congress who had offered that help. So they went on to investigate this, and what they said, well, the stimulus law specified that governors had 45 days after its passage to certify that their state would request and use the offered funds. And on February 18, 2009, Governor Perry sent Obama the requisite letter of certification assuring the president that the state would accept the funds and use them in the best interest of Texas. And then according to a National Conference of State Legislatures July 2009 report on state budgets, budget-writing Texas lawmakers were short $6.6 billion in revenue for the 2010-2011 years and relied heavily on stimulus funds for a solution. The stimulus aid let legislators put an additional $6.4 billion towards programs primarily Medicaid and education, historically financed with general revenues. That's according to a July 2009 House Research Organization report. Another $5.7 billion in stimulus money went to programs such as highway and bridge construction. So he comes up at about $12.1 billion in stimulus aid, which is $6 billion a year, and the state budget totaled $182 billion. So the dollar figures were correct. He also made a claim that Perry started blaming members of Congress who voted for the bill immediately after. And on February 18, 2009, the same day Perry accepted the federal funds, the governor slammed the legislation as being full of pork and special interest handouts. On his campaign website, Perry wrote, "The Demos think this bill will change our country's financial fortunes, but you and I know better. This administration is saddling future generations with increasingly unbearable debt." He then urged readers to sign an online petition telling Washington that they are fed up with bailouts. In his letter to Obama accepting the aid, Perry said, "As you know, I have been vocal in my opposition to this legislation because I believe there are better ways to reinvigorate our economy and believe the stimulus plan will burden future generations with unprecedented levels of debt. But I will take the money." He actually didn't say that.
It's nice to know that Governor Perry is in our corner on that.
Yes, and he's so consistent in his actions and his thoughts.
Well, we got a whole bunch more coming to you, but let's take a quick break. We're going to be talking about stuff going on in the Middle East. We're going to be talking about a suit against the LIBOR bank, a whole bunch more here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. We'll be right back after these messages.
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off. I said not to play it.
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny. That's not funny.
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the mama grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rood. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, host of It's All About Food on the Progressive Radio Network. Please join me every Wednesday at 3 p.m. when we talk about the power of the fork, how our food choices affect our health, the environment, and the treatment of animals. Learn how a plant-based diet of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds is not only delicious, but gentle on the planet.
Listening to the number one internet radio station for progressive minds, Progressive Radio Network.
I hope you have been spending a whole lot of time on the unemployment line yourself, but if you have, at least you can listen to the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown here on the Progressive Radio Network. We're back, and we're going to cut over to Jake with all the latest news coming from the Middle East, where democracy continues to cook despite the efforts of all the tyrants over there to shut it down. Jake?
Well, there's a lot of news happening today. First off, the most recent is there was a bomb in the city of Marrakesh in the country of Morocco in northwest Africa on the coast. Marrakesh is actually in the interior, but it hit the main tourist attraction. I'm going to completely butcher. This is the main square in the middle of the town. I have no idea how to pronounce it. But a cafe blew up. At least 15 people are dead. At least 10 of them are foreigners. There is no report on the nationality of those foreigners just yet because it just occurred. But the government has reported that terrorists are behind the attack. So, again, no idea, you know, the whole who caused this or anything like that, but certainly it's throwing a country that was in a fairly well off compared to the rest of the Middle East into a little bit more of a uproar. Also in Bahrain today, four Bahrain protesters have been sentenced to death. Court in Bahrain has convicted four demonstrators and sentenced them to death over the killing of two police officers during pro-democracy protests. Three others were sentenced to life in prison by a military court. They were tried behind closed doors on charges of premeditated murder of government employees. I guess my one reply to that would be, what about the charges of premeditated murder of civilians by the government?
Yeah, good
question. You never really see these regimes doing that. Bahrain, of course, had called in Saudi Arabian military forces who have put the country into a state of lockdown. And like all totalitarian regimes, they're just simply practicing the idea of shooting a few people and killing some and trying to get everybody else to be quiet that way.
As an example, right?
Right, because that's what socialism or totalitarianism, that's ultimately what they end up resulting in. So that country's very much in an uproar. And then if you head over to Syria, there's a lot of news coming out trying to there's been protests really against the current president of Syria, or really in reality a dictator, since the protests in Egypt. But it has really been accelerating. And just this week they were talking about placing sanctions against Syria. The United States, Australia, and European countries were stating this in the UN Security Council, which I don't believe it when they were in the UN, which is a little bit contradictory, granted all the Gaddafi's condemnations. But there are reports by the Associated Press of Syrian army units clashing with each other over following the President Bashar Assad's orders to crack down on protesters in Andara, a besieged city at the heart of the uprising. More than 450 people have been killed across Syria, and hundreds detained since the popular revolt against Assad began in mid-March. The protesters are again trying to get Assad out of power. But it's very interesting because at the beginning there wasn't really, it was a pretty unilateral stance, the government against the people. Right now this kind of shows that there is some cracking in the base, and about 200 mostly low-level members of Syria's ruling Ba'ath Party have resigned over Assad's brutal crackdown. So again, we have governments, you know, people are getting a little uppity, and you have to go shoot them. So,
interesting, a little bit of history rewriting in the article you're citing there, because they say that the struggles have been going on since March, but actually Syria's protests started in January. It's like, well, they're trying to eliminate January and February from the map or something.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it might also be an error by the reporters. But also coming out today is a pretty interesting report from the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. Yukiya Amano gave a press conference today stating that for the first time that the target that was bombed in Syria in 2007 by the Israeli Air Force was a secretly built nuclear reactor.
Mm-hmm. Really?
So, again, you can't know whether this guy is telling the truth or not, but it's you know, just kind of being brought out at a certain point in time, possibly to put additional pressure onto the Syrian government.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, if it was 2007, you said, what took so long to figure that out?
Well, it had always been suspected, even since really the day of it, because Syria kept fairly mum about when it did occur, and it was just kind of at an odd moment. So, again, Syria's future is still kind of murky, whether we're going to see continued unrest in Syria or not. And Syria has some similarities to Iraq in that it's not really a nation of Syrians. There's plenty of different religious groups. There's Christians, obviously Muslims, There was also a religious minority called the Druze, and they are kind of like a linchpin, really, for the rest of the Middle East, since Syria borders on so many other countries, such as Lebanon, Israel, and Iraq.
Yeah, a lot of stuff there. And an interesting thing I saw the other day, it was, now, again, you don't know how representative it is, but we do know that the unrest continues in Syria and in these other countries. I mean, the protests are practically daily. But this one particular resident, I think he was a resident of Daraa, was commenting, and he was obviously very anti-President Assad. He was commenting that he didn't care who came in. If the Israelis came in, he said, the Jews could send in their army, that's fine. If Obama wants to send in his army, that's fine. If Iran wants to send in his army, that's fine. Anything's better than Assad.
That's pretty bad.
It's very, very bad. I mean, it shows just how dreadfully bad things are in Daraa, and the fact that despite all the crackdowns, all the bombs, all everything else going on, that the protests continue tells me this is not going away anytime soon. This is going to be an ongoing issue.
Now, is it Syria that has close ties to Iran?
Syria does have close ties to Iran, and in fact, there has been some interesting speculation that perhaps Iran had sent some snipers to attack not only the citizens of Libya, but also the citizens of Syria. So, again, read into it what you will.
Yeah, it's hard to figure it out. But I did read that somewhere, I believe, and they said that that's the hesitancy of any country like or NATO or any country to act was because of that, because of the, you know, you can just imagine drawing Iran into any of these squabbles and... You know, that would be a mess.
No doubt about it. Is there anything more about the Middle East, or can I move on to Europe, Jake?
Oh, go ahead and move on to Europe.
All right. Well, there's an interesting article that appeared in the Washington Post in the World section, an article called Europeans Shift Long-Held View That Social Benefits Are Untouchable. And I don't even have to read the whole article because it says it all right in the line. But for years and years, the idea that the social safety net in Europe could ever be touched was kind of like trying to touch the third rail of Social Security in the United States. And yet now all the major countries in Europe are actually considering the idea of having to cut back on the social safety net. It looks like socialism may have finally expanded as it can expand, which is kind of surprising when you consider they do have a European Central Bank. The European Central Bank does create lots of money out of thin air, and that money can be used to basically monetize the debt of various governments.
That's
so
true.
If they've gotten to the point now where they're actually seriously talking about cutting that, it may be that Europe is a lot closer to an overall domino-type fault than we've been led to believe.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money.
Yeah, that's a great thing.
And Europe might be finding the same lesson as we are here in the U.S.
Right.
And that's the sad part, because this is a lesson that is going to hit the wrong people. It's not going to hit the people who have been caused the pain. It's going to hit the people who are the victims of it.
Who are already suffering.
Who are already suffering. It's going to hit the lower classes hardest. It's going to hit the middle classes second hardest. It's just a terrible thing.
Yeah. The interesting thing of money creation and money production and social welfare, and really all welfare, but you kind of, you know, it's really a gray area where you get into trouble, you know, as we already know. I mean, at what point do you get into trouble extending, you know, all these welfare payments and recipients and, you know, with the production of money? You know, you really don't know. I mean, it's just that I think it's just my personal opinion. It's just at that point when people start believing in the currency, they just say, you know, this currency's no good.
Or to put it another way, you run into trouble when you can't create enough money to spend anymore to keep expanding the crazy system.
Yeah.
Where it just can't be sustained anymore. You've expanded as far as anyone can tolerate in any of the financial circles, and the whole thing has to come to a collapse.
Yeah, the inflation is actually greater than the expansion, I guess. And
which, of course, is why if you're a member of LIBOR, you do everything you can to force the rates down. And we've been reporting on that over the last couple of weeks about how the governments of the United States, the United Kingdom, I believe the German government, and I think Australia have all been doing investigations of whether or not there was a LIBOR conspiracy, a conspiracy by the banks of LIBOR to force the reporting of interbank loans down. LIBOR rates, of course, are extremely important because they are, in most cases, the central fulcrum, if you will, for deciding whether or not variable rate loans of all kinds, including variable rate mortgages, go up or down. Well, it turns out that there is now a lawsuit pending. Vienna-based FTC Capital GmbH and two funds it operates have accused 12 banks of conspiring to artificially depress LIBOR and limit trade in LIBOR-based derivatives from 2006 to 2009, so actually outside of the range that was originally being explored and investigated by the various government authorities. The defendant banks include Bank of America, Barclays, Citigroup, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, HSBC Holdings, J.P. Morgan, Lloyds Banking, Norchunken Bank, Royal Bank of Scotland, UBS AG, and West LBAG. I mean, you're basically reading from the top 10 to 15 banks in the world on that list.
Who brought the suit?
The suit was brought by Vienna-based FTC Capital, GmbH.
They must have lost out in the deal then.
Yeah, they're not real happy, to say the least. They claim that, let's see if I can find the exact details. Well, they aren't actually providing a whole lot of details other than to say that there are about $350 trillion of derivatives and other financial aspects that are based in LIBOR and that the very small changes in that caused tremendous losses for the plaintiff in the suit. Whether or not that actually goes anywhere is another question, but just the fact that it's been filed is really significant, and even more significant is the fact that it's not getting a whole lot of play in the media, which tells me this is another case of something that's being suppressed, and when it finally does come to the public fore, it will do so at the worst possible time, when the whole pile is about to start falling apart.
Much like foreclosure mess.
Yes, exactly.
Which I don't know if you guys heard about the buyout that they kind of proposed, and really all I heard was it was proposed that the banks actually pay a small amount to everybody who's been foreclosed on, and that's the last I heard of it. And this was a federal solution for a state problem, or everything had been in the state courts. So.
So this is the way of solving the MERS mess? Is that the idea?
This was what, I saw that on an interview, and, you know, that was about 2 weeks ago. But it's the same thing. Like you say, you just do not hear. You know, we know it's in the 50 courts. All these, the MERS situation is in all 50 courts, yet I've heard, you know, that's all I've heard about it in months. So they were going to say that each bank would pay to everybody they foreclosed with the MERS process and pay them a small amount, you know, a few thousand was mentioned, and then everything would be fine after that. So,
well, I'll tell you, this whole question of suing LIBOR and the lawsuit claiming that they were suppressing rates from 2006 to 2009, LIBOR right now are very, very low. And it raises the question in my mind, how does the plaintiff in that case know that the whole rate suppression thing stopped in 2009?
Exactly.
And this is really critically important, because if not for LIBOR rates being held artificially low, and I'm suspecting that's what the case is, the event that we've been talking about since founded the show a year and a half ago, the likely event of a second mortgage meltdown coming in the fall of this year in 2011, that may be their way of putting it off, of preventing it from happening, or at least preventing it from happening for now. Eventually, those rates will have to rise, and when they do, there's going to be another mortgage meltdown there in addition to everything else that's going on. But this to me, strikes me as being very, very significant, this lawsuit that's being brought against LIBOR, because, first of all, it's unprecedented, and second of all, there's absolutely no reason to believe that if it happened during the time frame they talked about, that it has stopped since then. Moving on, we also have more information going on here from a variety of different angles. I want to talk about very briefly an article that I saw by Jim St. Clair. Now, I mentioned him earlier. He was the one who had predicted that QE and QE2 would continue even after its ending in June because the Fed was going to essentially monetize the payments made on the loans that they're holding on their balance sheet. And the only reason I want to mention this article at all is that I think it shows that even the people who are very good at this kind of thing make mistakes. In this particular case, Jim St. Clair claims that the key thing to take away from what's going on right now is that over-the-counter derivatives are the reason, in his words, what we're going through right now. The derivatives include the credit default swaps and all those. And he says there are approximately a quadrillion worth of these that have not gone away. And he says these are what actually caused the financial crisis of 2008. Now, the reason I say that this is where even the experts make mistakes, yes, that's true. Credit default swaps, derivatives market and so forth has played a tremendous role in the financial crisis, but they are not the root cause, because you cannot have a derivatives market unless you have a banking system that systematically lends out depositors' money.
Yeah,
Without it, there's no such thing as such a derivatives market.
Well, you can never. How could you ever have that figure? What it was, a quadrillion?
A quadrillion.
You can't
do
that without, you know, unreality shows what you need.
That's pretty much what it is.
Yeah.
And to make matters worse, of course, and he talks about this in his article, actually interview, that quadrillion worth of derivatives, in his view, is now worth about 700 trillion, only 700 trillion, you see. 700 trillion, which means it's lost 30% of its value. Frankly, I think it's probably worth a lot less than that. Jake, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Yeah, you have to be a little bit careful, because the quadrillion dollar figure, and I think the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, does the derivatives reporting really for the globe, and somewhere around 700 trillion, but that's what they call the notional value. So it's really just if you take the face value of the contracts and add them up. Now, if you tried to actually figure out what each of those contracts is worth, they try to, obviously, they make an effort to try and put a dollar value on it. I would just say that you really can't. There's no way to do it. The BIS figures for that is somewhere around $20 to $30 trillion the last time I checked. But what he's kind of getting at is what the BIS did is they changed the reporting requirements, and so that, in effect, is how they got the number to be a lot lower than it was. What you end up having is a lot of these banks are just piling derivative contract upon derivative contract, and where I think Jim Sinclair has a valid point is, like, when these things collapse, like long-term capital management, you have a lot of financial chaos, or even just one of these, and Lehman Brothers was probably directly linked to it. But yeah, absolutely agree with what you said, Walt. If you don't have this, if you take care and have a sound banking system using sound money, you're still going to have derivatives. Derivatives aren't all bad, but it's going to be far, far, far less. You're not going to have people gambling to make what they believe at the time to be risk-free profits.
And they're not going to make a gamble with other people's money. That's really the key thing. This market could never have grown as big as it has without the ability to use other people's money without their permission.
And eventually bail out all these problems with other people's money. So.
Absolutely. And you're right, Jake. Of course, the big problem is that they changed the so-called mark-to-market rules so that we really can't trust any of the information that now comes out of the banks in terms of what the value of the securities are that they hold, the various mortgages and so forth. Because
the investment bankers, they wouldn't have their yachts right now. We'd have a lot of trouble with that.
Absolutely. And as Sinclair points out, if we actually did know what the real numbers were, all the banks would be in default anyways.
Yeah. Well, you know, at least the yachts are real.
Well,
they have a value.
When everything comes crashing down, at least we can go sailing off into the sunset.
Yeah, or, you know, 100 people can live on one or something.
Well, at least a few people perhaps can sail off into the sunset. Most of us probably can't, but Jake probably can't because he has his condo. You know, is your condo floating, Jake?
Not yet, but
yeah, you're in the middle of the country right now.
No, I guess a couple more news events concerning really just war. Tunisia reported some explosions across their border by Libyan forces pursuing the rebel forces. So you have a little bit of spillover over the border there. And then if you flip around to the other side of the world, you have Thailand and Cambodia. They're still continuing a battle, or they were continuing for almost very many years, a standoff over a tourist attraction, a temple that had been really ceded to the country of Cambodia, but Thailand was going after it with their military, and they have come now to a ceasefire and have set up weekly conferences between the leaders. I don't think there's any resolution on the ownership of the temple, but I guess where that has, and you might say, and I think 15 soldiers have died, and there's been a few people displaced from their homes during all this fighting. But what it really kind of comes down to is something we haven't really touched on for a while, which was that the Thai military took over the government. I believe they said, and I would actually have to double check to get a little bit more up to speed. But at the time, you had these protests against Thailand's government. The military took over. They said they were going to bring elections. To my knowledge, there hasn't been. I might easily be incorrect. but the Thai military is using this kind of as an excuse to build a little bit of patriotism behind their own government. So it's kind of interesting to see how countries end up, or nations, states end up kind of copying each other's manners, attacking this country, attacking that, to build a popular resentment and a common enemy.
I'm not sure I could call that manners, but
manners.
But your point is a valid one, and it's a constant recurring theme in our report, and indeed in what goes on with all the reporting from all the media. We have all these different struggles for democracy going on, all the violence that goes with it, all the wars going on, and we've got all of this money being created out of thin air by all the central banks in this race to the bottom. Is there a connection?
Race to the bottom.
It certainly seems like there's a connection to me. I also want to bring something else up. We just have a few minutes left here in the program, but this is actually something from 2009, so it's kind of old, but it comes from the St. Louis Fed. And I think it's just kind of interesting to touch on now, especially now that we're leading into, we've been experiencing some inflation that nobody in the government is willing to admit exists, and we're about to hit a whole bunch more, especially based on the comments that the Walmart CEO gave us last month about what's going to happen starting in June. This is an analysis that came from the St. Louis Fed. It was a news release, and the headline of the release was, St. Louis Fed Analysis, Will the Expansion of the Monetary Base Lead to Inflation? Now, it doesn't actually say so in here, but the monetary base from the point of the 2008 crisis up through the end of 2009 tripled from $800 billion to $2.5 trillion. And, of course, you and I, Jake and Gene, we all know that when you increase the monetary base, you're basically destroying the value of the dollar, and you're setting the stage for future inflation.
Right, in certain asset classes.
That's right, in certain asset classes at first, although in the long run it affects all the asset classes.
Right.
It just it takes a while for the whole thing to kind of set itself up, because the only way that the actual inflation takes place is through a whole series of transactions that lead people to believe that they're able to get more for their product and so on and so forth. The thing that's interesting about this news release, well, there are two things interesting about this 2009 news release. One is that they headlined it, that will expansion of the monetary base lead to inflation? And clearly we're starting to see that now. But the second thing is, that was the last thing they said in the article about leading to inflation. They didn't discuss inflation for the rest of the article.
You're kidding.
It was just in the headline, which really points very clearly to what Jake was alluding to earlier. They are very good at telling both sides of the story and contradicting themselves and covering themselves as they go along. Here was an example, right in the middle of an article itself, within the same article, they changed their tune. So, I mean, it's just amazing.
And, it is amazing.
And as I'm reading through this article, and they're basically in total denial about the possibility that there could be any increase in inflation and about how necessary the whole thing is going to be, toward the end, there was probably the most bizarre comment of all. It was a comment by, let's see if I can find the gentleman's name, Gavin. Do you know who Gavin is? I know I recognize the name, but I can't find it. Oh, here he is, William T. Gavin. He's a vice president and economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. And Gavin's comment about the monetary base itself and the effect that it was going to have was very simply, says, when the time comes to shrink the monetary base, the Fed could allow the lending programs to expire as the loans mature and sells the assets outright. So what's he talking about? Well, he's talking about all those loans that were taken onto the Fed balance sheet in the first place in order to bail out the banks. The very same assets, which now Ben Bernanke is saying, well, once QE2 ends, we're just going to continue monetizing using those. So he says, when the time comes to shrink the monetary base, the Fed could allow those lending programs to expire. Well, here's a question for you. If the only thing that's holding together this so-called recovery is the QE2, and that QE2 is based on those securities taken on board to expand the balance sheet, and if reduction of those assets on the balance sheet actually starts to shrink the money supply, which tends to have deflationary impact, what's going to happen to the economy?
Mm-hmm. And isn't that a little bit late anyway?
Just a little bit late. Well, unfortunately, we're nearing the end here, and I hate to have left on such a negative note, but we are coming to an end of another very informative program. And Jake and Gene, as usual, it's been a pleasure. I want to remind everybody, please visit us at our website at www.freedomnewshour.com to find out the latest and greatest about upcoming guests. And we will see you guys next week.
Okay, take care, everybody.
Hey, stay free, everyone.
So long, everybody.